So this is the second half of the first lecture. I'm still on the war for the moment. But I think it's important to understand the social changes in the war, because that's what will change people's attitudes in 1950. And I already mentioned the expression that war is an accelerator of history. Yeah, that in those 6 years, 1939 to 45, many more things changed than in other periods of 6 years. It really completely, because war tests the government structure, the health system structure, the military structure, the social structure, everything is tested. And also, people have extreme experiences during the war, and it can completely transform their idea of what is normal and what kind of society they want. Yeah. So it's not surprising that I spend more time talking about the 6 years of the war than other periods, because they really mark people. And I'm sure if you have parents or grandparents who were in some war, the years of war are more remarkable than average years hanging around in the suburbs of Paris like I am doing at the moment. I want to look now at opposition to aspects of the war. It's certainly true that in the Second World War, like in the First World War, there was a very broad consensus in favour of the war and in favour against surrender. There was a very, very, very broad consensus. And this has made a big difference to how the war is remembered. Of course, the Second World War for France is very complicated, because first of all, you had part of France occupied, and then part of France not occupied as such, and of course the entire population was divided, and so the memory is quite complicated. Whereas in Britain, it's very simple. There was no invasion, so there was no need for any huge division, and so people liked to remember the Second World War. It was very simple. The British were good, the Germans were bad. The French and the Russians were kind of complicated, and we won. You know, that's how simple it can get. However, there was some opposition to the war. First of all, the pacifist movement before the war was quite important, was quite big. The experience of the First World War, which was seen and still is seen by many people as a terrible crime, carried out in the interest of the elites and against the interest of the ordinary soldiers and civilians, meant that in the 20s and 30s, there was a certain amount of pacifist organization. In particular, the Peace Pledge Union was formed in 1934. In 1934, the Peace Pledge Union was established. And the Peace Pledge Union still exists today. It's an interesting organization. And if you want to join the Peace Pledge Union, you simply have to sign a promise. I reject war, and I will never support or sanction another war. Signed, Billy Elliot. And that's the Peace Pledge Union, 1934. A lot of quite famous people signed it. The novelist Aldous Huxley, the one who wrote Brave New World. The ex-leader of the Labour Party, George Lansbury, the poet Siegfried Sassoon, some very famous people signed the Peace Pledge, and this became an important element. And during the war, the Peace Pledge Union had several hundred small groups in different towns, and they campaigned against bombing. And they made leaflets that said, the people of Dresden are not our enemy. It was politically impossible to give out leaflets against the war, and also you would probably be arrested. But it was possible to give out leaflets saying, we do not want to bomb German cities, because civilians are not our enemies. And so they carried out campaigns during the war. Nevertheless, they were not mass campaigns. So the war continued. 1941, the German army advances on Moscow. October 1941. December 1941, the Japanese forces attack the American fleet in Pearl Harbor, because they want to. They think that America is about to join the war, and so of course to destroy the American ships first. Seems to be a good idea. In 1943, there is the uprising in Warsaw, where the Jewish population organized a kind of an enormous insurrection, a revolt against the Nazis. Most of them are killed, but it's very important moments. And in 1943, you have the first meeting in Paris of the Conseil National de la Résistance. The military situation changes in June 1944 with the Normandy landings, what you call in French le débarquement. Yeah? And there's a tremendously good film about it called The Longest Day, Le Jour le Plus Long, which is I'm not generally a fan of military films, but it's a very, very good film. 1 million American soldiers and hundreds of thousands of British and Canadian soldiers arrive in France. And then, if you're a soldier at this time, it depends if you're lucky or not, because some of the places they arrived and the Germans weren't ready, and they just arrived and they were okay. And in other places, which are the most famous of ones, of course, it was a terrible moment. If you've seen Steven Spielberg's film Saving Private Ryan, yeah, it's a tremendously dangerous thing. So it was kind of, if you were lucky, there were also some beaches where they arrived and there were no Germans, and so they just said, right, hello, we've come to liberate you, and they had a good time, yeah. But so it was a very, very varied thing. Destruction of Tokyo in March 1945 by firebombing, tremendous. The beginning of the end then, the liberation of Dachau, the first liberation of a concentration, a death camp in April 1945. And Adolf Hitler commits suicide in April 1945. And then in August 1945, you have the nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, at the end of the story, at the end of the war, 360,000 British were killed. Now, that's much less than other countries, yeah? Far, far less than Russia. Several million people were killed in Russia. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's like something, it's something incredible, like 10 million or 20 million or something. Life had changed. People's attitudes had changed. Women's lives had changed. But also, there had been a change in ways of governing. During the war, the elite understood that it was absolutely necessary for the government to control industry if they wanted to win the war. Now, in the 1930s, and before the war, an enormous section of the elite said, nationalization is very bad. Yeah, only private capital can make the economy move forward. And this was a general argument, nationalization is impossible because it's terrible and private industry is wonderful. And during the war was a moment when government control of industry was tested, and it worked very well. And so after the war, it was much more difficult for the Conservative Party to say, nationalization, we can't do that, it won't work. Also during the war, the welfare schemes were much bigger than before. Free vitamins for children. It's very interesting that during the war they introduced free vitamins for children. Now, they could have introduced free vitamins for children in 1925. They have the science, they have the technology. But the difference was, in 1945, the elite didn't care whether people were in good health or not. Whereas during the war, they needed everybody in good health. The civil service, la fonction publique, for people working for the government, was multiplied by three during the war, because the government controlled more things. It is estimated that the war cost Britain 28% of its wealth. On dit que la guerre a coûté à la Grande-Bretagne 28% de ses richesses. De ses richesses, c'est-à-dire tout, les bâtiments, les chemins de fer, les usines, tout, tout ce que possédaient les Britanniques. 28% was destroyed. Pas de son revenu annuel, mais de tout ce qu'il avait. Now, to mobilize people to this extent, it was very, very important to be able to, for the elite to be able to say to people, life will be different after the war. Before the war was the 1930s, mass unemployment, terrible poverty. And so during the war, the government said, things will change. Although the left-wing politicians and writers were in support of the war, they were also very critical of society. In 1941, for example, the very famous writer George Orwell wrote a collection called The Lion and the Unicorn, where he demanded important social change after the war. Even more famous, of course, is the Beveridge Report. Lord Beveridge was a liberal politician. Sorry, I'm writing it in French. I should be writing it in English. My English is getting worse and worse. The Beveridge Report. The Beveridge Report was a report on social services. So it's a government report, yeah? It was written on the order of the government. And it has a series of ideas for the health service, housing, and social policy in general. It sold 600,000 copies. Now that is absolutely amazing. You know what government reports are like. They are extremely boring. Yeah? When was the last time you bought a government report? Yeah? Nobody does. But during the war, this report was tremendously popular, and it was seen as a promise. It was seen as a promise as what will be done. And the most famous phrase is this one: from the cradle to the grave. Du berceau au tombeau. And it's the idea that it is the job of government to take care of its people from the cradle to the grave. That is to say, if old people are too old to work, they should not go hungry. For important sections of the population, these were new ideas. For example, if you are unemployed, it said in the Beveridge Report, if you are unemployed, you should receive money to help you to live. Now, it was a big section of conservative opinion was against this. They said, if you give people money when they're unemployed, they will become lazy. This was a very, very, you can still hear this idea today, but in general today, the consensus is unemployed people deserve to get some money. But at the time, it was a big controversy. It was a big fight. So from the cradle to the grave, and we will see more about that. We will see more about that as soon as we get on to the next section. And I just want to say a few things about culture. Because the difficulty with these classes on Britain since 1945 is, of course, that I'm going to concentrate on social and political history, because that's what we normally do in civilization classes. But I want to make sure every week there is a good chunk of cultural history as well, a history of culture. And the culture of Britain, I'm talking about, the novels and the artists and the cinema and so on, was very much influenced by the political situation. First of all, in the 1930s, at the end of the 1930s, many Jewish people left Germany and came to England. Certainly, every Jewish person who had family in England came to England. You know, it was just the time. There were also many Jewish children who came to England during the war, because in Poland and in Austria, I think it's Austria, certainly in Poland, Jewish families began to understand what was happening, and they very often gave their children to tourists. So they just find a tourist and tip them the shoulder and say, please take my child to England because it's too dangerous here. So it's a terrible, terrible... many tourists just arrived in England with a baby and they had no way of contacting... Of course, the parents were killed later. So very tremendously tragic situations where the Jewish parents who had understood the situation before the others just had to give their children away to literally to tourists, not to friends. It was a terrible situation. But there were also many Jews who came deliberately, adult Jews who came deliberately. One of the advantages of the war is that Britain inherited a few Jewish artists. Arthur Koestler, a novelist and writer of memoirs. Very, very interesting. What he writes is very interesting. A tremendous artist. A visual artist, a painter, Oskar Kokoschka. One of the greatest German artists of the 20th century. What I love about Oskar Kokoschka is that he continues painting until he is like 96 or something ridiculous. You know, he's really, really old. He lived very old. And also, moving to England at this time, Ludwig Wittgenstein, a noted linguist, linguistician, and philosopher. So these are just three examples. There are many more, but there were certain important figures of culture who moved to Britain to be safe. There are also a certain number of poets writing in Britain during the Second World War, but the tradition is very different from those poets of the First World War. The First World War poets in Britain are probably the most, yes, certainly. Now, as you know, for many people, poetry is something you study at school and then forget forever. Yeah, that's what happens to a lot of people. However, if in France there are two or three poets that people still know, and it's the same in England, and the most famous poets in England are the poets of the First World War. Siegfried Sassoon, Wilfred Owen, the ones who wrote terrible poetry about the tragedies of the First World War are extremely popular today. I mean, people who don't read poetry will know those. And so I wanted to look at what about the poets of the Second World War? Well, it was much more difficult to write poetry in the Second World War. First of all, because it was no longer possible to glorify war. That was the story was over. But secondly, the First World War poets presented war as a unique, presented the First World War as a unique tragedy, a unique aberration. And the whole thing about the Second World War is that, it's the Second World War, you know. This is what, of course, in the 1930s, they didn't talk about the First World War. They talked about the Great War. The Great War. The war to end all wars. Okay, but there are some poets in the Second World War, Alan Lewis and Keith Douglas, for example, are two poets in Britain who wrote about the Second World War. Can be quite rough. One of the poems, for example, is about dogs eating dead soldiers. Yeah, you get the picture. You know, it's not. What's the name of that guy who sings Happy? It's not like that Farrell thing. It's not like that at all. Okay. There's also perhaps one of the most famous poems, which you can find online, is by Henry Reed, and it's called "The Naming of Parts." And it's about how boring it is to be in the army, which is an interesting point. So much for the poets. I have a couple of novelists I want to talk to you about. So first of all, one that you've heard of. In fact, there are two here that you will have heard of, but perhaps not necessarily for their best work. Aldous Huxley is very famous for... That's right, Le Meilleur des Mondes, Brave New World, which I recommend. It's quite a good little piece. At my daughter's high school, they got them to read it recently, so it's still around. But it's not necessarily his best, I don't think. And I'm not going to give you too many. But in 1936, he'd wrote Eyeless in Gaza. It's a novel, I think. And in 1939, wonderful novel, After Many a Summer. The good things about these novelists is because they died quite a long while ago, very often you can find their work free on the web. After Many a Summer. After many a summer dies the swan.